From colonial times, religious congregations and religious organizations in the United States have been providing not only for the spiritual needs of their congregants and communities, but for their social welfare as well. The Brookings Institute tells us that until the close of the 19th century, religious groups were virtually the nation's sole provider of social services. Good morning. This is Faith Matters on 89.9 WJCT. I'm Kyle Reese, senior pastor of Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church and board member of One Jacks.
And I'm Nancy Bronner, executive director of One Jacks, an institute of the University of North Florida. Faith Matters is WJCT's quarterly program, taking a closer look at today's issues through the lens of faith. Social work, the profession now dedicated to caring for the human and social needs of society's disadvantaged members, is rooted in religious theology and practice, but became more secular in the early 20th century. While churches were the only social safety net the country had for many years, it was the Great Depression which ended this role. An article in Sojourners explains that the Depression crippled churches' finances, and the economic downturn forced them to slash services when people needed help most. Religious leaders and local church members alike recognized the crisis, and many demanded that the federal government intervene. The result of this process was the enactment of the Social Security Act in 1935.
So what is the role of faith communities in our social safety net? You can join our conversation this morning by calling 549-2937. We want to hear your views and experiences.
Here to help us understand the role of faith communities this morning in the social safety net are Audrey Moran, Senior Vice President of Social Responsibility and Community Advocacy, Baptist Health, and former President and CEO of Sulzbacher Center.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Colleen Rodriguez, Executive Director, Jewish Family and Community Services.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for being with us. Audrey, in your role as CEO of the Sulzbacher Center, you saw the many ways that faith communities interacted with the center. Can you talk a little bit about that interaction?
It was very, very important to the success of our women, men, and children who were residents of the center, over 300 on any given day. And so we saw interaction with the faith community in a variety of ways. Serving meals was a big way. Many, many church groups from across the community came in on a regular basis and served breakfast, lunch, or dinner to our residents. No small task. We also had other ways that we interacted. Financial support from many, many religious institutions. Use of space for offices for some of our staff members at downtown churches that had extra space. So there was a lot of support, and support especially for the interfaith nature of our work. We had people from every religious background at the center and from no religious background. And so it was really important when the faith community stepped up to say, we support and care for you all, no matter what your background.
Mm-hmm. Colleen, at Jewish Family and Community Services, my assumption is that the needs are overwhelming. So talk about how in your work you prioritize or focus your energies to meet those needs.
The needs are overwhelming and they're ever changing in some ways, and in some ways they stay the same. So we're a 101-year-old organization, and I would tell you the work that we do meeting basic needs is the same that we were doing back in 1917 when we were established. I think now it's more about listening to the community and listening to the clients that come through our door every day to hear what's going on and what changes in their world and environment, and how do we need to change and be flexible and paying attention so that we don't just do what we think we need to do. We're doing what really makes sense for the people that we serve. A lot of that is doing things like this, coming together with other professionals and other community leaders and talking about what we're seeing and hearing.
Colleen, can you talk a little bit about the work of Jewish Family and Community Services? What kind of services do you provide, and who is your audience? Who do you reach?
Our audience is the entire community. So absolutely, Jewish Family and Community Services was established with Jewish values and to help the Jewish community 101 years ago. But we absolutely serve the entire community. Over 80% of our clients are not Jewish. Mm-hmm. Our services really they're around families and stabilizing families. So it's basic needs, it's food, it's rent, it's mortgage, it's counseling, and then to higher levels, working with children that have been abused and neglected, all the way to adoption services, and working, and also, of course, working with our Holocaust survivors.
Mm-hmm. Audrey, in your current role at Baptist Health, you have a network of faith partners. Talk about those partnerships and in what areas do your faith partners work, and how does Baptist resource them?
Sure. So Baptist Health is a faith-based healthcare system. We are very tied to that mission in the community and giving back. And part of that is reaching out to the faith communities all over our city to say, how can we help you? It can be something as providing health education and information to congregants. It can be partnering with other institutions to have health fairs in communities of need, and basically providing the kind of information that folks are looking for to be healthy. For many people across our community, their particular faith institution is a safe place to go. And so with that safety comes access and willingness to hear information that's desperately needed all across our community.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the role of faith communities and the social safety net, and we invite your calls at 549-2937.
Colleen, you mentioned a minute ago an aspect of your work that perhaps a lot of the community is not familiar with, and that's the support you give to Holocaust survivors. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So we have 88 Holocaust survivors that reside in Northeast Florida, and unfortunately, I have to say that over 60% of them live at or below poverty. So we're really working with them and making sure they're being fed, making sure they're getting their medical needs met, getting to medical appointments, that they have adequate housing, and that they're being cared for in a respectful manner. We also have the first gallery, Holocaust Memorial Gallery, the Frisch Holocaust Memorial Gallery on the East Coast. So people are welcome to come and see that as well.
And tell me what's there.
So the first exhibit is actually photos of some of our survivors and their families.
Oh, wonderful.
Audrey, your title is Vice President of Social Responsibility and Community Advocacy. So when we talk about the role of faith communities in the social safety net, we run into an issue of scope and scale. So talk about ways that faith communities can advocate to multiply their efforts on a larger scale.
So that's a really interesting question. You know, people feel throughout faith communities, and people who are not tied to faith communities often feel a real desire to give back, to make a difference. That's sort of the core of what does my life mean? And so you'll find lots of times, and we see this I saw this at the Sulzbacher Center. I see this in lots of organizations that Baptist Health partners with. People want to do something tangible. Example, hand someone a plate of food. That is a very powerful experience. And of course, you've fed someone. They're no longer hungry. There's a reward that comes from that immediately. You see the difference. But if we're going to think about things like poverty and social justice, that also requires advocating to people in leadership positions who can really set priorities for funding, set priorities for how we're going to spend tax dollars across our region if we're going to invest more in areas like mental health, which is a huge need in our community. That requires advocacy on a different level. That requires rolling up your sleeves and getting engaged in things like the city council, in the legislature, in races where you know that people can make a difference if they understand the needs of our community. So that communicating with people in leadership positions, very, very important, but can be daunting to people, can be intimidating. And so I think one of the things that we need to do as a not-for-profit sector is help people understand the role of advocacy, how they can do it, take down the obstacles that might intimidate from people from getting involved. And you know, I know on your next segment, you've got the Reverend Mark Griffin. That's somebody who got involved in a real way by running for office himself. Mm-hmm. So lots of ways to get engaged. But I do think that's something that the not-for-profit sector can really work on together is how do we advocate as a community to let our leaders know what we think the priority should be.
Colleen, you've also been known as an advocate, and I know you've done a lot of work speaking out about the needs in this community. Would you want to say anything to add to Audrey's perspective here?
I would second everything Audrey said, and I would also say that I think it's often more powerful when a family or a person who's received services or a person who has volunteered who doesn't work in our sector stands up and says, oh my goodness, this is what I've experienced. I think that's a more powerful statement sometimes mm-hmm. than even when Audrey and I are speaking to people.
Wonderful.
She's right about that. At Wolfson Children's Hospital, we've really found that that is the biggest way to sway legislators about healthcare funding mm-hmm. is when we have a child and their parents walk in mm-hmm. to a legislator's office, sit down and say, but for the care we received at the Children's Hospital, my child wouldn't be here today. Mm-hmm. It's hard to turn away from that. And you can really understand why those dollars make such a difference.
Mm-hmm. There's a book that's, Colleen, there's a book that's making its way around faith communities entitled When Helping Hurts. Mm-hmm. And so we can't make the assumption that every faith community is doing good things to help the social safety net. What are some advice you would give to any faith group who wants to make meaningful change and just from lack of education or intentions ends up hurting people?
I think it's important that they understand what their mission is and they stay true to their mission. I would say the same thing to any nonprofit, that we all have a mission. And once you get off track, that's when you get into trouble. So really, what are the goals? What are the goals that you set? And stay true to those. I would also say if it's your first time really trying to partner and make a difference in the community, to partner with someone who's already doing that. Mm-hmm. There are nonprofit organizations with various missions that are always looking for partners. And to do it together at least the first couple of times before you would go out on your own would be my recommendation.
Very important. Let's go to the phones. And we are going to speak with Sam. Sam, you're on the air. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, my comment is this. Let me first make this statement. I'm on the ballot for the school board, and I have a dilemma. How does the faith-based community incorporate the school system if there is a separation of church and state? I've been on discussions with One Jacks, with Nancy Brunner and those before, and we've had excellent discussions, but this is something that we have not addressed. So what is your take on the faith-based groups where there is a separation of church and state? How do we incorporate that and collaborate with them?
Sam, thanks for your question. That's something that we in One Jacks actually had a conversation a few weeks ago. And it is a very difficult situation in that faith communities want to do good. And so feeding the hungry, providing school supplies, all of these things. Where we have concerns, I think, is when faith communities begin to draw a line, step over a line, and begin to look at partnerships with schools as opportunities for conversion. Mm-hmm. And we have to be very sensitive that as we embrace these partnerships, again, because faith communities want to do good, but we have to be very clear to define what that is in the school setting.
That's true. And I think that it's important to recognize that the faith communities are an important resource, a place where many people turn to in times of need. And so Kyle has already explained this need to be very careful in knowing what's appropriate, but we certainly embrace the help from the community in the district. Audrey?
You know, schools have become much more than just a place where a child goes from 8 to 2:30 to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic. The reality of our public school system today is the children have many, many needs. And so at Baptist Health, we've opened school-based health clinics through our social responsibility work in partnership with many, many other wonderful organizations to really serve the healthcare needs of these children. Many other organizations come in and provide clothing closets, provide food in the evenings after a PTA meeting. So there are ways that the faith communities can intersect, can completely honor the separation of church and state, but still intersect in these wraparound services mm-hmm. that these children need outside the school day. And as we know, schools are a safe haven in many communities. Mm-hmm. In some communities, the only safe haven. And so by really bringing the community into schools both before and after school, there's many, many ways that there can be that good interaction.
So important. Colleen?
And I would say the same thing. Jewish Family and Community Services, we're in 10 middle schools providing dropout prevention through Achievers for Life program. We're a mental health provider in the Arlington feeder pattern. So there are ways in which you can bring the faith community's resources to the schools, but make it about the families and not about converting and recruiting, but just meeting basic needs. Mm-hmm. And that happens every day.
Absolutely. We'll go to the phones, and we're going to speak with Darice from St. John's. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, I'm with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and we have a tool that is not affiliated with our faith, but we have built it as a volunteer portal that churches, that community groups, that schools could use to access needs, opportunities to serve, and also people and individuals, families, faith groups who would like to find a way to serve and get plugged in. I find that sometimes there's kind of a barrier to entry where people want to get involved but don't know how. And so this tool, justserve.org, brings volunteers and organizations together. And we have found it's been wonderful for families. For example, we've done produce cleaning and then gathered produce and gone and delivered it to food banks and homeless shelters.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. And Colleen, that's an important point about collaboration. Where is collaboration happening in our community among interfaith organizations or faith groups to help the social safety net?
I think collaboration is happening a lot more than we think. Definitely the nonprofit sector is always meeting and communicating. The faith-based community is becoming part of that. I would say that's wonderful that her church is doing that. I would also say that United Way now has a new website portal that we're able to put volunteer opportunities and ways for people to get linked. I think United Way is really their focus and their mission in Northeast Florida is bringing the faith-based community into the nonprofit sector and us having worked together and to be able to really communicate to the community where uh-huh. need is.
Absolutely.
Well, and I think, Audrey, and I would be interested if you would agree with me, a lot of our struggle is lack of communication. There's such good work being done, but we're duplicating services because we're just not talking to each other. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think it's something we need to be careful about and be aware of, and I think we're improving on that in Northeast Florida every single day. The work of organizations like Jewish Family and Community Services, and I want to say that what that organization does is extraordinary in our community. The work is so overwhelming each day. The time it takes to really bring in other people to talk about the sector and have that time to reflect and plan is precious. Mm-hmm. So I know at Baptist Health, one thing we do each year is have a community partner breakfast. We have 100 agencies that we partner with across Northeast Florida, and we bring them together to say, what are you doing? How are you working? Have you all met each other? Do you two know that you're on similar tracks? Are there mm-hmm. ways you can collaborate? And the feedback we've gotten from that is amazing because it does give people the opportunity and the space to have those conversations. But, in the time that I've been in Northeast Florida and involved in the not-for-profit sector, I've seen us improving on that every single mm-hmm. year. And the Nonprofit Center of mm-hmm. Northeast Florida helps bring people together. That's something that's not in every city, so we're fortunate to have that. But could we always do better on the collaboration piece? Mm-hmm. The answer to that's yes.
Sure.
And I would say I'm always cautious to use the word duplication. That's always been kind of thrown back at the nonprofit sector that we're all helping the same five people. What I would tell you is the need is great. Mm-hmm. And we're not helping. We are talking. We are communicating. Many of our data systems are linked and they're live. So I know if they've left one facility and have come to mine. And so we're really cautious about that. There's very few dollars, so we want to make sure we're using the dollars and spreading mm-hmm. them and putting them where we need to. So there is a lot more communication than I think we have had it previously.
And it sounds like then some advice we would give to faith communities that want to be involved in what's happening is look for those conveners. Look for those mm-hmm. people who can connect you with other groups and two organizations sitting around the table today.
Yes. And we have another caller. We're going to speak with Michael in Orange Park. Go ahead, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I came into this conversation a little bit late. I'm in my car, so if I've missed some important information, please excuse me. And if I haven't, hopefully you can share with me. I'm in Clay County, as obviously Orange Park, and I work with faith-based community to help the needy. And most of the time, it's people who are just needing a little extra help with their rent, food, electricity, whatever it may be. So many of us live paycheck to paycheck, but not being as informed in the community here, I see there's such an absence of facilities in the community, such as a homeless shelter, as Jacksonville has. What can we as a community, or who can we put the pressure on in this community to provide a better resources for these people that are in need? It's so difficult to get the faith-based community to rally together under one umbrella, unified front to help everyone. So people are either not slipping through the cracks, or unfortunately it happens, have the tendency to abuse the system, to keep that from occurring. Any words, and I'll take advice, and I'll take your comments off here.
Thank you so much, Michael. Audrey, I know that Baptist supports some organizations in Clay County. What would you say to Michael about a way to generate more help, or maybe as in the role of convener that we just spoke about?
Yeah, thank you for your call, Michael. This is a real problem in Clay County. The lack of services for vulnerable populations is real, so you've hit on a true need. This is where the conversation about advocacy comes in. How do you rally a community to really understand the needs? And there is a growing population of people with means in Clay County, which is helpful when you are trying to convene folks together to say, how can we take care of those who are most in need? So at this point in time, what you need is to think about what is the groups that we could pull together to have a discussion about what the numbers look like. And I would call on experts in other communities to come in and help paint that picture, and invite your elected officials to be part of that, and invite potential funders. I know the Reinhold Foundation, which is a very large Clay County Foundation, has been looking at this for many years. Perhaps you could ask them to do a convening in a place where everyone could gather and begin the discussion. It doesn't happen overnight, but it's important that you have the facts and the information and the data that can paint the picture of need, have some people that can talk about potential solutions, tell the stories of how needs have been met in other communities, and then put together a plan to make it happen. It's not an easy task. That's why people don't do it. But you are correct. It is much needed.
Mm-hmm. And in response to that, Audrey, we haven't always had the Sulzbacher Center. So talk a little bit about how that came about.
That's actually a wonderful, wonderful story. It took leadership, right? And so the Sulzbacher Center actually came into being because of the leadership of then Mayor Ed Austin and then City Councilperson Jenny Myrick, who said, we have a real need for a place in our community that had comprehensive services, not just a warm bed and a hot meal, but also healthcare services, daycare for children, job resources. How could we get that kind of comprehensive center? And Mayor Austin and Councilwoman Myrick really led the effort to find a location. That was really key, and then pull together community funders to make it a reality. It was not the center that it is today. It started in a warehouse with people sleeping on the floor. The men in the community called the floor the parking lot because it was yellow painted lines and a sleeping bag, and that was your bed. Of course, it's grown into something much, much more now, especially with the opening of the Sulzbacher Village for women and families, healthcare being more than 50% of what's done there. So it's an evolution. But leadership's important. And if you can get a leader in the community to take hold of the issue, others will follow.
And do you find that in Jacksonville, especially, that we have evolved in these services beyond just the basic needs, which, of course, you need to satisfy those needs just in terms of daily survival for a lot of folks, but getting at more of the root causes and the deeper issues? What have you seen, Colleen, in your experience?
Absolutely. I think now we're really looking at prevention. We're looking at generational. We're looking at the cycles that families go through. Look at the opioid. We're all talking about that now. You know, substance abuse is often very generational. In the child abuse arena, we're doing a lot more intervention early. Let's get in there. Let's build skills. Let's do parenting. Let's do budgeting. Let's try to alleviate some of those stressors so that child abuse doesn't happen. So I think we're trying to be less reactive and more proactive in our approach. I think training and awareness, all of that is all coming together now. And we're starting to see funders and donors being willing to pay for that versus just swooping in, I'm going to save the day and do this. Now it's, wait a minute, let's get ahead of this and let's really build systems that make sense and prevent some of the cycles that are happening that we're seeing.
We're talking about the role of faith communities in the social safety net. We invite your conversation at 549-2937. We appreciate you calling in and adding to this very rich discussion. Colleen, is it fair to say that in many ways, the faith community continues to be the front door for many people in need?
Absolutely. People feel comfortable. People feel safe. I think we used that word earlier. Going to the facilities that they've grown up with or that are in their communities that they're seeing. And very often the referrals do come from the faith-based communities to the nonprofit sector. And that's how they make their way to us.
And do you, either one of you, have words of advice for someone working in a church who or any faith community who encounters an individual with needs?
Know the resources in your area. Understand what is available. We can't expect our faith communities to solve every social problem that we have. But there are partners out there that can really work together to make a difference and serve people who are in need. We hate to turn, no human being wants to turn someone away without help. So understanding what those resources are, knowing about United Way's 211, which can connect people to services all across our community, you know, understanding what's out there and understanding that the not-for-profit sector is very open and desirous of partnering with a faith community.
I agree with everything she said, and I would just say to start building those relationships before someone's in your door. So if we're talking and meeting and having conversations and we're familiar with what you're providing at your facility, what I'm providing at mine, and then when someone comes in a crisis, I know exactly who to call.
Later in today's program, we'll talk with several community members who will share their experiences about providing social services. Audrey Moran and Colleen Rodriguez, thank you so much for being with us today. You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.9 WJCT. I'm Nancy Brauner, Executive Director of UNF's One Jacks Institute.
And I'm Kyle Reese, Board Member of One Jacks and Senior Pastor at Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church. We'll be right back with more Faith Matters.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, a live call-in program where you talk about the biggest stories in the state.
This Friday, a new report says thousands of Confederate monuments remain in place across the South, including many here in Florida. Also, election protection. How secure is your Florida ballot this summer and fall?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, exploring DIY jazz with music from the DC Jazz Festival.
It's donation-based shows for the most part. All the money from the door goes to the artists. It's just really just an open, inclusive situation for artists and musicians.
I'm Christian McBride. Join us on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back to Faith Matters, WJCT's quarterly program exploring today's issues through the lens of faith. I'm Nancy Bronner.
And I'm Kyle Reese. If you're just joining us, we're talking about faith communities and their role in the social safety net.
As we continue our discussion, we welcome to the studio Reverend Mark Griffin, senior pastor and chairman of Wayman Ministries.
Good to be here.
Glad to have you. And the Reverend Beth Jo Flatt, an urban missioner for the Episcopal Diocese of Florida and founder of Church Without Walls.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Pastor Griffin, Wayman Ministries is a multifaceted organization, but tell us specifically about the Wayman Community Development Corporation and how it came about and the needs that it addresses.
Well, Wayman Community Development Corporation came about 23 years ago as we believe it or not, this was during the era of computers first coming online, and we realized, particularly in the African-American community, there was what we call the digital divide. And so we actually did a computer workshop where we were trying to train young people on how to use the computer. And lo and behold, what we discovered was that we had more involvement and interest from the parents of those children than even the kids. And so that's how it started, and now we are involved in after-school program care, child care, mentoring and counseling services for our children. And that also supports our charter school, Wayman Academy of the Arts, where we serve K through five children. And we just do a number of things primarily focused on children and connecting with their families.
Mm-hmm. Beth, your calling to ministry led you to create Church Without Walls, which is a remarkable story in and of itself. And in that calling, you say that you practiced what you call spiritual listening in downtown at the Sulzbacher Center and at the Clara White Mission. And what were the needs that you found in doing that that led you to create Church Without Walls?
Well, early on, I spent a lot of time on the street just talking to people, but I also spoke with people at social service agencies to get their perspective on what missing pieces there might be. In talking with Cindy Funkhauser at Sulzbacher, she said, just being with people. Those in social services are really taxed. They can't really spend a whole lot of time with people, and so we saw a need to learn how to walk alongside someone in their suffering and in their journey, and just to affirm them as they made their choices and find their way.
You use the word suffering, Beth. Mm-hmm. I know that you've been quoted as saying our best growth comes out of pain. I imagine you see that pretty often in your work.
I definitely do. On the street and also in work in hospital chaplaincy, and just you read spiritual material, and that just seems to be a truth. And I think the fear when people feel repulsed when they see a homeless person or a mentally ill person, the reason they react that way is we're afraid to confront our own weakness and suffering and the darkness within us. And so it's a mutual ministry. We train folks to learn how to be able to be present with their own suffering, mm-hmm. so they can walk alongside someone else. And somebody who's sort of in the ditch, if you're not willing to enter into your own ditch, so to speak, they're not going to trust you. They can sense that. So it's really powerful.
Pastor Griffin, I see you nodding. do you have some experiences in this area?
Absolutely. And it's so interesting when you're working with people at that personal level. Particularly when you win over their trust, you begin to really dig deep into some matters that, as Reverend Beth mentioned, it sometimes causes you to begin to unearth some things in yourself. And so you're right. It is definitely mutually beneficial, not only to the person that you are serving, but so often the person that you think you are blessing end up being a blessing to you. So it's definitely
absolutely.
Mutual.
Yeah.
Pastor Griffin, when you look outside the church walls as you have done and seek to make a difference in the larger community, the needs can be overwhelming. How have you prioritized how you address those needs, and how do you stay focused when I'm sure there's many opportunity for mission drift?
That's a great question. If you had asked me that question some 10 years ago, as you may recall, we were really dealing with a lot of murder and everything in 2006 and 7. And I spent a lot of time trying to coalesce all across the city. But I decided to just kind of zero in on a particular area. And so our ministry really focused on Eureka Gardens and the West Side, and we just decided we could not continue to try to be all things to all people. And so we really decided, based on where our ministry was physically located, let's see if we can develop a blueprint in helping address the issues at Eureka Gardens. And so we've been fairly successful. There's still a lot of work, still a lot of improvement to be made, but we just decided to focus on our immediate neighborhood, and I would be I would hope that other churches, other faith ministries would just kind of zero in on their one block, their one zip code or whatever. And I think if we all started to do that, we could begin to make a difference. Because, again, the person who is hungry, we want to feed them a meal, but we want to get to the root cause of, mm-hmm. of their situation, mm-hmm. education, health, whatever it is. And you can't do that by being real broad. You have to really become a ministry that goes deep into the lives of people.
Mm-hmm. You can join our conversation this morning by calling 549-2937. Reverend Beth Jo Flatt, talk about the community you serve and tell us a little bit more about Church Without Walls.
Sure. The community we serve, Church Without Walls started in downtown Jacksonville, and that's really where we are, although, of course, we're anywhere, but started with just walking the streets and talking to people, talking to agencies, and then providing companionship. So our first ministry was a coffee fellowship outside at Clara White that's almost 6 years old. We serve coffee every Wednesday. We're there just to offer fellowship if somebody wants prayer, and that continues weekly. So people got to know us because we show up consistently. A lot of times churches sort of swoop in quarterly, which is great, but that's very transactional. Mm-hmm. And so we don't do stuff. We really are about presence and being together. And I think people picked up that difference. And then out of that, we started a worshiping community mm-hmm. that meets on Sunday afternoons and anywhere, probably 60% homeless and the rest urban poor, and then also people from church pews that are looking for relevance mm-hmm. and something very real will just come and be with us for that simple space.
Both of you have touched on this issue of root causes, sustainability. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to feed someone who's hungry and give them a bed, but both of you are doing work that really gets at root causes of the person's condition. And Mark, I know that you have Wayman Charter School.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit more about this issue of meeting basic needs and then building some strength within for these people yes. to have access?
And Nancy, you know from your years on the school board how we've worked so hard to make a difference in the lives of these children. And through a lot of hard work and prayers, our school is now one of the top schools, an A-rated school subject to the grades that will be coming out soon.
Yeah.
But we serve a population of students, and we're proud to say that about one-third of our students walk across the street from Eureka Gardens, which is an area that has a lot of challenges. And what we found was that before these young people could navigate reading and writing and math and all these things, they had so many issues in their upbringing, in their home, and some of these issues had become multi-generational. And it was amazing that young people just had no exposure. There was a limit to what they thought they could be in life, and so we had to deal mm-hmm. with that. Children who had experienced crime and murder, parents in jail, parents gone, and I found myself thinking if I wasn't so blessed to have two loving parents, hardworking parents who instilled in my life and my siblings the importance of education, that could very well be me. And so I think as we serve, as Reverend Beth mentioned, this cannot be transactional, because mm-hmm. the young people and even older people, they can tell when a faith community is just there for the photo op or just there for the opportunity to say I've served X number of meals. There's an old saying that people don't care how much you know unless they know how much you care. And they can sense that. And through our Charter School Wayman Academy, our students sense that our principal, our teachers, our staff, we really care about them. And I think we have to work harder at making sure that the people that we serve that they sense that we really care.
Beth, you were talking earlier about those who have joined with you, looking for a sense of meaning. Talk about partnerships and where folks have come from to work with Church Without Walls. And maybe what are some of the aha moments that you've seen those volunteers or those individuals have?
Oh, really powerful moments. We partner with faith communities outside of the Episcopal Church, and even some community service agencies will provide hospitality and come and worship with us. One example of an aha moment, a woman who was visiting from another church went and sat down along a wall at the edge of where we meet with a man who was clearly hurting, and carried on a conversation, and he didn't understand why she was talking to him. And he said, I have so much anger in me. It's like it hurts all the way through. And she called a little boy from her youth group over and introduced him. And she said, you know, Bobby, you have a problem with anger, don't you? And he said, yes, ma'am. And she said, well, what's that like? And he said, it's like it hurts all the way through my entire body.
Oh, gosh.
And so there was just this powerful connection of understanding that we're just part of the human family. Some of us might smell better than others, but we share so much in common.
Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned a couple of times, Pastor Griffin, what advice would you give to a faith leader who would very much identify that we're in the business of right now of transactional help? We're giving a meal, we're providing a tank of gas, whatever that, and wanting to move to relational ministry. What are some words that you would share?
Well, I think I would suggest that instead of worrying about the sheer number of people that you serve, just focus on a smaller group. Mm-hmm. And again, really get to know that person, that family, and begin to understand why they are where they are. I think that's the most valuable thing, because what then happens is that family or that person, they will begin to share with others that I ran across this leader, this pastor, and they really care. They took the time to have a conversation with me. And so that is what really begins to build the trust. And let's face it, we live in a day and age where a lot of people don't trust the faith community. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't have faith in the faith community, we can't really do what we feel God has called us to. So we have to rebuild that trust by really focusing on talking to the person like they are a person.
Yeah.
And again, as I said earlier, they can tell, they can smell out a situation where a person is not really there truly to assist them.
Mm-hmm. Beth, you want to?
Sure. Very early on, I rode with Dr. Dick Christensen, who was at Sulzbacher Center, yes, and so phenomenal. And so he would allow me to go with him when he cared for psychiatric patients on the street. And we met a woman. She'd been on the street for 12 years, and we got out of the van, and she recognized the Sulzbacher driver and Dr. Christensen, of course. And I had no badge, so she looked at me and she said, well, you're not a doctor. Who are you? What are you? And I almost didn't want to tell her, but I said, well, I'm a pastor. And before I could say anything else, she said, oh, so you're here to make me feel bad.
Wow.
And it just broke my heart. So we have work to do to learn to love people where they are.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Beth, it's interesting. I think the attendance decline of the mainline denominations is pretty much what everyone is aware of. But you offer a ministry where people can find meaning and change their lives, and they themselves can be changed. I think that's a very hopeful avenue of ministry.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it will help the mainline church revive, because it's that missing piece. We're sitting in the pews itching to do something that really matters in this strange social media world we live in. People really want to find connection. Mm-hmm. And I've had people who left church who came to Church Without Walls and then ultimately returned to their congregation to make that connect. So there's just a funny disconnect. It's like we forgot in the Episcopal Church, we're sent out to do God's work at the end of every service. But I think we lost touch with what that means.
And if I can add to that, I think if I can be real blunt, I think sometimes as faith leaders, we can be just downright mean and rude and very judgmental. And I think people pick up on that. We have to be careful not to carry a condescending spirit as if we have it all together. We're halfway to heaven already. Because the reality of it is we all have our issues. We all have our struggles. Ours may not be as public, as noticeable as others. But I think people pick on that and they pick up on that. And so we have to be very careful as leaders that people don't see us as being judgmental. We have a calling to love everybody. Mm-hmm. And so many times we get caught up in people who don't look like us, who don't worship like us, who don't love like us. And that judgmental spirit, it turns people off. So I think that has impacted the decline in church attendance as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've talked about and you all have referenced is behavioral health. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who come to us for help or whom we encounter are in need of behavioral health services. And if we want to talk about overwhelming needs, that is one that's staring us in the face. What are some ways that you have partnered with behavioral health professionals? Where is the help that you look to help you minister to these with whom you encounter?
I think for me, the greatest partnership has been with Sulzbacher Behavioral Health and getting to know the people that work in that area and referring people there. And it's also about building trust. I think folks in behavioral health are mistrustful that sometimes that religious folk are going to poo-poo what they do and diminish it or discount it. And so it's very important to have a relationship. I know the folks that I work with, I defer to them. I'm there as a support, but they are the trained healthcare professional, not me. And so we have to work as a team.
Right. And we have a program called Life Change Counseling Services that's actually funded by the State Department of Juvenile Justice through some of our great legislators here, Senator Audrey Gibson and State Rep Kim Daniels and Tracy Davis. They championed that funding that we've had for a number of years. And it works in our charter school with our children. And you would be amazed at how much services these children need. And so, as Reverend Beth said, we believe in prayer and helping people through that process from a spiritual standpoint. But you have to have licensed mental health workers who are trained in the area of counseling. And that's what our program does to help these young people when they find themselves in trouble.
And we have a caller. We're going to speak with Terry from San Marco. Go ahead, Terry.
Yes, I just wanted to pass on that I spent 14 years trying to teach algebra in a failing school where I would believe that by the time they were 14 years old, especially the boys, their bodies were growing so fast that they couldn't see the board. And I remember not having enough seats in the front row when I'd say at the start of the year, how many of you can read what I just wrote on the board? And all the hands would go up. And then I looked at studies on kids that get in trouble young, and the percentage of the kids that are in juvie were, again, couldn't see, their eyesight just wasn't taken care of. If there was some way to outreach to teachers, I don't know the case in the lower schools, in the K through 6 schools, but if you were to talk to teachers and you really want to change the course, kids will change their own course under neglect if they have the tools to do it. Kids understand neglect better than anybody. And if you give them the dignified way of helping themselves, which would be a great through a pair of glasses, if there was some way to outreach with those kind of professionals and get all these kids glasses, I really think you could have a real punch to the systemic issue of what's happening here.
Thank you, Terry.
I'll take your response. Thanks.
Okay. So thank you so much for bringing up a really important issue. I know that the school districts do have vision screening, and the Lions Club has been, it's been a major project for many years. But of course, the need is out there. Right. Mark, with your kids, what do you see in your school?
Yeah. We see exactly that, and we do a lot of vision screening because, again, if the child can't see, they can't read. And to your point, what then happens, they begin to fall behind in their education. And That's a very embarrassing thought, that I'm not on grade level. And so what happens, children often, they will act out, and they become discipline issues because they're trying to mask the fact that they are not where they need to be academically. And to the caller's point, it could be something as simple as needing a pair of glasses. And so we need to continue those services and encourage our parents to take advantage of those.
And we talked earlier in the show about adopting schools and faith communities doing that. It just struck me as the caller was speaking, Beth, perhaps we might be encouraging our faith partners that are working with schools to do some spiritual listening as well. Let the students, let the teachers, let the administrators dictate, this is how you can help us.
Absolutely. I think it's really important. You know, it can be kind of arrogant sometimes. A faith community can have an agenda and an idea. And I went on a mission trip when I was in seminary. We went to South America and met with a group in Ecuador. And they were stunned because we didn't have any agenda. And we kept saying, we want to know what you need. How can we be helpful? And when they realized we meant it, it was the most amazing transformational conversation and the beginning of a relationship. And so you have to get to know people, mm-hmm. you know, and they have to trust that you care.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you mentioned earlier the term when you were talking about sometimes faith communities swoop in, mm-hmm. Which you were referring to faith communities sort of dipping in for a moment in time, but then leaving, and it erodes the ability for people to trust.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why you're there. Mm-hmm. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I would say we have to be very careful with that, because I can remember when we were doing a lot of work with Eureka Gardens, and every day Eureka Gardens was in the news, and it seemed as if almost every faith-based nonprofit organization was trying to schedule something in Eureka, and this group wants to preach to the residents on this Friday, another group want to preach. But the residents, they did not need a sermon.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel that people would rather see you live a sermon than hear you give a sermon.
Amen.
And so we have to be careful about that ability, that the idea I'm going to swoop in and get my own name in the headlines, because, again, the residents, the people that need the help, they can really discern when someone is there for them, as opposed to wanting them to be there for the name of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think what is so remarkable about both of your ministries is one of the reasons people swoop in and then swoop out, this is hard work.
Yes.
There are no easy answers and very few that can be solved in just a 30-second soundbite. And so you have stayed the course and are making a difference. Any closing thoughts that you would share with those who are listening with us today?
I think my closing thought would be not to be afraid to step out and to try. Good. And that there's support available for that process.
Beth Jo Flatt and Mark Griffin, thank you so much for sharing your wonderful work that you're doing in the community. And thank you for joining us, all of you, for this edition of Faith Matters. We're committed to bringing you diverse opinions and perspectives on matters of faith, and we'll be returning each quarter with new voices to add to these conversations.
This show's producer is Kevin Murchard. If you missed any of today's program, you can find the podcast later today at wjctnews.org. I'm Kyle Reese, senior pastor of Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church and board member of One Jacks.
And I'm Nancy Bronner. Thank you for joining us.